This series contains adult language and depictions of graphic violence. Listener discretion is advised. So I have a personal connection to the state of New Hampshire. Yes, I grew up in New Jersey, but my dad's side of the family are all New Englanders. My mom's a New Yorker, but my dad was in Connecticut as a kid before his family settled in New Hampshire by the time he was in high school. He and my mother met at the University of New Hampshire, which is also my older brother's alma mater. The house my dad's family moved into in the 1960s was a Georgian-style farmhouse built in the 1760s. There was what's called a lean-to addition built sometime in the 1800s, but the original two-story house had a galley kitchen on one side of the first floor. The other side of the first floor was dominated by a large dining room, living room, and library surrounding a central fireplace with a narrow stairway leading to three upstairs bedrooms. It's an amazing house, with so much of the original construction surviving that it would blow your mind. The floorboards, for instance, some of them are more than 20 inches wide, and they're all chestnut. If you're into woodworking at all, you'll understand how incredible that last sentence is. And the land the house sits on is strewn with these massive granite outcroppings, some of which were harvested and hand-hewn to use as pieces of the foundation of the house. And surrounding the home for miles in all directions stand majestic hardwood forests with stands of old-growth beech, walnut, hickory, and cherry trees. The house still stands on a picturesque hill on a road that horseshoes around, connecting at both ends to a two-lane highway that'll take you north and west away from the Massachusetts state line in the greater Boston area. I spent many Christmas vacations sleeping in front of a roaring fire and summer breaks running through the woods to a beaver pond just over a small rise at the top of the hill, trying to keep up with my brother and cousins, avoiding poison ivy, and never knowing what was going to happen next. Exactly the way a summer day should be when you're young. But at night, the older kids would start in with the ghost stories, because as far back as I can remember, I was told the house was haunted. Welcome back to The Devil Within. You're listening to The Old House. New Hampshire is tucked into New England like a puzzle piece. It's roughly the shape of a right triangle, with a long vertical eastern border with the state of Maine, a short southern border with Massachusetts, and a meandering western border with Vermont along the Connecticut River. Interesting to note, in most cases where a river marks a boundary, the midway point of the river is the official dividing line. Not the case here. The actual boundary is the low watermark on the Vermont side. So the entirety of the Connecticut River along the Vermont border belongs to New Hampshire. The point of the triangle actually forms a short international border with the Canadian province of Quebec, and far to the southwest, there's an even shorter coastline along the Atlantic Ocean between Maine and Massachusetts, a coastline that was fought for to allow the state some shipping and fishing revenue back in the day. Similar to the other Northeast states we've covered recently, New Hampshire was originally inhabited by Algonquin-speaking tribes, specifically the Abenaki, for more than 10,000 years before the first European explorers arrived. In the 1600s, the English showed up, and by 1629, the province of New Hampshire had been established, named after Hampshire County in Britain. Almost exactly 150 years later, in 1776, New Hampshire was the first of the English colonies to establish a government independent of the British Crown and enacted its own constitution. In July of that year, representatives from New Hampshire attended the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia and signed the Declaration of Independence, with Josiah Bartlett, a family doctor from New Hampshire, being the second signature on the document after John Hancock. The state would be heavily involved in the Revolutionary War, providing troops, ships, and supplies throughout the entirety of the conflict. In 1788, New Hampshire was the ninth state to ratify the new U.S. Constitution. A bastion of abolitionism from the start, New Hampshire committed 32,000 troops to the Union cause during the Civil War, including 18 infantry regiments, 3 rifle regiments, 1 cavalry battalion, and 2 artillery units. Of the New Hampshire troops sent into battle, more than 6,000 would die. The post-Civil War industrial boom greatly affected New Hampshire, with hundreds of mills dotting the Connecticut and Merrimack rivers. And for a time, the Amiskeag Manufacturing Company in Manchester was the largest textile plant in the world. New Hampshire is also, at once, among the wealthiest and most educated states, as well as the least religious state in the Union. New Hampshire is also famous for her fierce libertarianism. When residents of the state proudly exclaim their motto, "Live free or die," they mean it. New Hampshire is the only state in the Union without a seatbelt law, and only one of 3 that don't require helmets for people riding motorcycles. There's also no income tax in the state and no sales tax. But don't worry, the government still gets its money through higher than average property taxes and a statewide liquor tax that brings in hundreds of millions of dollars. But back to our story. As stated, I spent a lot of time as a kid in the woods of southern New Hampshire and staying in my grandparents' supposedly haunted house. Along with my brother and cousins, I grew up with the stories. I remember listening intently, over and over, hoping that one day I would be the one responsible for carrying on the oral tradition of these seemingly paranormal events. And here we are. As I write this, I'm not entirely certain that any of these tales have been written down before. That's weird to think about, but here we go. And look, none of these are anything like the events I've described in previous episodes of the show. No demonic possessions, no physical attacks from beyond the grave, nothing really inherently frightening, aside from the supposition that entities from a different plane of existence were affecting our reality. That's usually enough to scare the shit out of someone, and it certainly was for me. The first story I remember hearing about the, quote, old house, which is how we referred to the place, had to do with my aunt. As a young mother, she was visiting home with her infant daughter. One afternoon, she was descending the stairs with a baby in her arms, when a loose board caused her to trip and begin falling headfirst towards the wall at the bottom of the staircase. She remembers there being a flash of light, and instead of a horrible, painful crash that could very well have seriously injured or even killed both her and the child, she realized that they had been softly deposited on the bottom stair with no harm done. My aunt swears to it to this day. Then there's the story from years earlier about my dad as a teenager, asleep in his bedroom when he was awoken by the sound of his dog, Jed, coming into the room and laying down in his customary spot on the small rug on the floor beside the bed. The click-clack of Jed's nails on the floorboards, followed by the gentle sounds of his breathing, was comforting and reassuring, and my dad was able to quickly fall back asleep. But then he woke with a start, suddenly remembering that Jed had died earlier that year. My father claims he then reached down and felt the rug, and it was still warm from where his dog had so recently been sleeping. Now, my grandmother was a tough woman, loving and kind, but with the type of toughness required to live in the New Hampshire countryside. Noises in the night didn't scare her, but there was one story that, I admit, often made it tough for me to fall asleep. This particular story took place after my dad and his sisters had left for school, and my grandfather took a job that had him in California for long stretches of time. So, yeah, my grandmother would be alone in that house, which basically meant she was alone in the damn woods. One night, as she slept in her upstairs bedroom, she woke up to the unmistakable sounds of someone or something climbing the creaky wooden stairs that led almost directly to her bedroom door. She knew when whatever it was had reached the top. She strained her eyes in the darkness but couldn't make out what, if anything, was now standing in the doorway to her bedroom. Then she heard what sounded like something jump, immediately followed by that same something landing on the bed. She could feel where something heavy was weighing down the covers on her legs, but still, she couldn't see that anything was actually there. She gave a mild shove with her leg and admonished the unwelcome visitor with, "Shoo, go on, get out of here." Then just as suddenly as this thing jumped onto the bed, it jumped off. But she never heard anything land. Then she just went back to sleep. My grandmother would tell other stories. Harmless, always harmless events, like the couch cushions being sat in when the last thing she had done before bed was smooth them out. A random clearing of the throat from the next room when she was home alone. And one involving my mother, I think before I was born. She was in the kitchen with my grandmother when the cuckoo clock chimed. My mother commented on how lovely it sounded and asked when they had gotten it. "Oh," my grandmother replied, "we don't have one. They just like to be playful." "Huh. They do, huh? Okay." My mother decided not to press the issue. The only time an actual apparition was ever spotted was by a guest who claims to have seen a ghost browsing the bookshelves in the library. The spirit was allegedly spotted through a window as this guest was exiting the house, and only for a moment. But this sighting would be important later on. The only event that allegedly happened during my lifetime was the Christmas party incident, but I was too young to remember. A little setup is required here. Just up the hill from the old house sits a similarly old house, but much smaller. It's uphill enough where the first floor of that house is level with the second floor of the old house. It's also situated in a way that if you were to look out the living room of this neighboring house, you could look directly down the upstairs hallway of the old house. The other thing to keep in mind is that this neighboring house was occupied by my great-grandparents, and they like to keep an eye on things. The story goes that at a Christmas party in the late 70s, my great-grandfather called to tell the revelers that a light had been left on in an upstairs bedroom. That's such a dad thing to do. Anyway, he asked, could someone please go turn it off, as it was a silly waste of electricity and money didn't grow on trees, grumble, grumble. The call was ignored, and everyone went back to the party. What my great-grandfather didn't know was that earlier in the evening, with all the ghost stories floating around the party, my grandfather got fed up and dared whatever spirits were in the house to show themselves. After a tense few moments of anticipation, nothing happened but the phone call from next door, the call that was ignored. A few minutes later, great-grandpa called again. "Well," he said, "I don't know what kind of crap you're trying to pull, but whoever went up there left all the lights on, clear down to the back bedroom." That seems strange, as it wasn't some big raging party. Anyone leaving would be noticed. But no one had left, not even to go to the bathroom. Not that much time had passed. Intrigued, my grandfather went upstairs to check things out and realized that every door down the hallway was shut and locked. Every light was out, and all the light bulbs had disappeared from their sockets. It would be 7 more years before my grandparents decided to sell the old house, but they wouldn't go far. Just at the top of the hill, a few hundred yards away, a piece of land on high ground, and would build a nice little home to retire in. A few months after they moved out, the new owners of the old house invited them over for coffee. And after a few minutes of pleasantries, They asked outright if they had ever had any problems with spirits in the house. My grandfather coolly replied, "Problems? No." "Huh. They asked because, well, if you know New England, there are almost as many antique shops as there are Dunkin' Donuts. And the new owners were collectors of antiques. Naturally, they made sure all windows and doors were locked each night. But every morning, the windows were unlocked and even a little open, and all the doors as well. There was never anything missing or stolen, but still, it was unnerving. It was decided that the spirits in the house were just letting the new people know that they didn't need to worry about security or theft. Nothing bad would be allowed to happen. They also mentioned seeing a ghost in the library fairly regularly. I missed that house and actually got to visit it just before COVID after almost 30 years. It seemed smaller, less spooky, but absolutely beautiful. I didn't ask the current owners if they had any paranormal experiences, but my brother did. The man looked at him kind of strange and said, "Not really that I'm aware of, but every now and then I smell smoke. Not smoke from a fire, but sweet smoke, like tobacco smoke, like from a pipe."
Wow.
Just about every day of his life that I can remember, my grandfather smoked a tobacco pipe in his office. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Kids, work, marriage, exercise, that new series on Netflix, maybe lunch with an old friend. What would you do if you could have an extra hour in your day? Now, I admit to having wasted some precious time in my life, wishing that I had more time. But time for what? See, that's the question. If you could manage to squeeze in that important activity, what would it actually be? Knowing what's important to you is one of the keys to happiness, and a good therapist can help you find what matters to you. Why? So you could do more of it. It's 3 years now I've been telling you guys how I've benefited from therapy since I was in my late teens. That's 30 years, on and off. It's where I learned how to be a grown-up. Seriously. How to communicate, how to set boundaries, how to stop procrastinating, how to take the right chances in life. With every session, my toolbox expands. If you're thinking of giving therapy a shot, consider BetterHelp. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient for you. You just fill out a questionnaire and you're matched with a licensed therapist. And if you ever want to change therapists, no problem and no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/devilwithin today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/devilwithin. About an hour and a half east of Greenville, New Hampshire, that's the small town where the old house still stands, an hour and a half east of that is the city of Portsmouth. Portsmouth lies north of Boston on the Atlantic coast, the largest city of New Hampshire's short 18-mile coastline. Near downtown Portsmouth is an ancient cemetery dating back to colonial times. It's known locally as the South Street Cemetery, due to its location at the corner of South Street and Sagamore Avenue. For centuries, known as the Point of Graves burial ground, the name South Street Cemetery took over and has become the official name, at least colloquially. The high ground nearby is still called Gallows Hill, for obvious reasons, although no one has been executed there for a few hundred years. But back in the day, first the hanging tree, and then the gallows saw a brisk business. They called it, quote, "turning the cart," because the condemned was brought to the gallows in a horse-drawn cart where they would then stand and have the noose placed around their neck. Then, at least three different men would stand some distance from the horse and call for it. The horse would walk away, pulling the cart from underneath the feet of the condemned, where they would then hang until dead. The reason for the multiple men calling the horse was that so no one would ever actually know who the horse was responding to. Therefore, no one would know who actually caused the death, and the men's consciences would be clean. Similar to the firing squads of old, three riflemen, but only one had a live round, so no one would ever know who fired the fatal shot. Around the time our story takes place, 1768, there seemed to be a bunch of things that you could be executed for. But this tale has more than its share of tragedy, and it shows how far we've come as a society with regard to what is socially acceptable, especially where women are concerned. In June of 1768, Ruth Blay was a 31-year-old teacher in Southampton, just up the coast from Portsmouth. Ruth was single and living alone. Today, that would mean absolutely nothing. A single 31-year-old woman living her life, we wouldn't think twice about it. But back then, she was labeled a spinster, a derogatory term for an unwed woman considered to be out of her prime. Today, we know different. Also today, single women having children is commonplace. Either by choice or circumstance, the woman is not considered a pariah or broken or dirty or unworthy. All that bullshit that society used to pile onto women when what was actually called for was support and understanding. Anyway, in the summer of 1768, Ruth Blay did the unforgivable. She became pregnant out of wedlock. She did what she felt she had to do. She hid the pregnancy to keep her job and her standing in society. As the day approached when the baby would come, she secretly consulted with a midwife and made whatever other preparations she could to have the child secretly. And then, hopefully, she'd be able to leave town and settle somewhere to start a new life. To her perpetual sadness, the baby was stillborn. Well, now what? Nearly incapacitated by her grief and shot through with fear of those who would surely judge her incorrectly, Ruth made a terrible decision. She concealed the corpse of her newborn beneath the floorboards of the schoolhouse where she worked. Within a few days, her secret was discovered by two of her students, and they reported the find. Ruth was arrested while the investigation began. Although she admitted to being the child's mother, she claimed the baby never drew a breath in this world. The local coroner disagreed, claiming the baby, quote, came to death by violence. Ruth Blay was indicted on one count of murder and private burial of her bastard child. That's actually how the charge read, murder and private burial of her bastard child. The punishment, if convicted, was, you guessed it, death by hanging. Her trial began on September 3rd, 1768, and she was convicted on September 3rd, 1768. She refused to name the father during her testimony, and although she claimed to be able to prove her innocence due to her, quote, having prepared to care for the child, circumstances, if proved, would have been grounds for acquittal, but no one came to her defense. She was condemned to hang on Gallows Hill on November 24th. The governor of New Hampshire at the time was Benning Wentworth, and he seemed sympathetic to Ruth's case. He granted three separate reprieves that gave Ruth hope that a pardon might be coming soon. But the town sheriff, a man named Packer, was obliged to do his job and maybe got a little overzealous. There are differing accounts of the events of December 30th, 1768, the new date set after the last reprieve from the governor. But one version is that although the execution of Ruth Blay was scheduled for 1 p.m., Sheriff Packer's wife had prepared a particularly wonderful lunch for him that day, so he moved up the hanging time by an hour. The executioner's cart arrived at the jail to collect Ruth, and her cries for mercy could be heard all through town as they made their way up to Gallows Hill. Once arrived, the noose was placed without delay and the horse was summoned. At just past noon, Ruth Blaze's pleas were silenced forever. Then, at 12:45, a messenger arrived with a reprieve from the governor. Ruth Blaze was buried in Point of Graves burial ground in an unmarked grave, probably nowhere near that of her child. And nowadays, if you happen to be walking through Portsmouth at night, you just might hear the wailing of an innocent woman condemned to death, reliving her last ride to meet her fate on Gallows Hill. Thanks for listening to The Devil Within. Make sure you're following the show so you never miss an episode. You could also check out our socials at The Devil Within Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Until next time, stay safe out there. The Devil Within is a Cloud 10 Media production, recorded live at Bel Air Studios in Los Angeles, California. Written and produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Sim Sarna. Our post-production supervisor is Bruce Witkin, who also provided original music for this episode. For The Devil Within, I'm your host, Brandon Morgan.
Hey there, I'm Amara Kofer, and I'm the host of the show Black Girl Gone. In this podcast, I tell the stories of missing and murdered Black women and women of color in America. I want to bring light and awareness to all of these powerful stories. I focus on a neglected demographic and missing and murdered cases and send my love and respect to the victims. I recommend listening to Black Girl Gone on the iHeart app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.